Communications Lead here at Stream, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to today's webinar, New South Wales Election 2023, What to Expect. I want to start today by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet and pay respect to their elders, past, present, and emerging. The run-up to the 2023 New South Wales election has been anything but typical. This term of government has seen an unyielding stream of challenges for the coalition, both in terms of policy and personnel. Fires, floods, and of course the COVID pandemic would have been plenty for any government to reckon with. That's all before you get to the major infrastructure projects, service delivery challenges, and economic headwinds all in play. Add to that a government which was forced to replace a very popular premier with a relative unknown at the height of the pandemic, and a party that, after 12 years in government, is challenged by pre-selection issues, and the political landscape is starting to look increasingly difficult for the coalition. But that's not to say this is a layup for Labor. They've got their own set of challenges too, with internal party debate over policy and a very tough electoral map that makes a majority win for them look difficult. It is safe to say that this election is well and truly up for grabs, with the latest poll showing Labor ahead on the two-party preferred, but Perrottet the preferred premier. So let's get into it. For our discussion today, I'm joined by four experts in New South Wales and Australian politics. Clive Matheson, partner of strategic communications consultancy Cato & Clive, has worked at the most senior levels of the media industry, state and federal politics. After 25 years working in the media, including 5 years as editor of The Australian, Clive served as senior advisor to New South Wales Premiers Mike Baird and Gladys Berejiklian. He then served as deputy chief of staff and chief of staff to Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull. Eamon Fitzpatrick, Managing Director of Fitzpatrick Advisory, is a veteran of state and federal Labor campaigns and governments over the last two decades. Building on extensive experience in state governments, Eamon served as Senior Press Secretary to Prime Ministers Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard, was Bill Shorten's Head of Strategy during his first year as Opposition Leader, and he was also Communications Director for Maurice Yama, the last New South Wales Labor Premier to win an election. And following his time in government, he's advised major global businesses on effectively engaging with Labor governments. Annie O'Rourke is the founder and chief creative officer of data strategy and delivery agency 89 Degrees East. Annie was a senior advisor to Prime Minister Kevin Rudd, the founding CEO of Media Team Australia. In her time in government, she directed major national government campaigns. And Samantha Hutchinson is the national reporter at the Australian Financial Review with a particular focus on New South Wales state politics. Prior to this, she headed the CBD column across the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age for 3.5 years, and she's covered business, state and federal politics, including Victorian state politics at the Australian, the AFR and BRW. So during the last 15 minutes of this session today, our panellists will be answering audience questions. Please use the Zoom Q&A function, which you can find at the bottom of the window, to submit your questions, and use the little thumbs up button to upvote those you'd like to see answered. Finally, today's discussion will be recorded, so if you're not able to stay for the full hour, a link to the recording will be in your inbox soon. So without any further ado, let's jump into it. And I think we'll come to you first, Sam. You're the one that's really in the thick of this campaign. Do you want to give us a bit of a state of play of where things sit 4 weeks out from polling day?
So there's a bit of polling flying around at the moment. We had a freshwater strategy poll that was out on Monday. And the most fascinating thing that we saw, so we've got Labor ahead on two-party preferred terms at the moment by a tiny margin, 53-47. And that's the vote has tightened from what we saw in October last year when Labor was ahead on 54 to the coalition on 46. But the most astonishing thing that we're seeing at this part of the campaign is we've seen this jump in popularity for Dominic Perrottet, which I think has caught quite a few people by surprise. The other thing that we're seeing is that's actually somehow pulling up the appeal of the Liberal brand as well. It's surprising because, I mean, it's been a nightmare run, actually, for Perrottet over the past 2-3 months. He started the year off with, you know, as the victim of friendly fire, with some news that he wore a Nazi uniform to his 21st birthday. We're still waiting for a photo to appear, if it does actually exist, but there's very much a sense that These revelations came from within his own party. And that really speaks to the sense of it's a coalition that could be getting a bit tired and a front bench team that maybe it's still not as cohesive as you would expect it to be this far out from an election. More recently, you've had Perrottet losing his most trusted factional ally, the finance minister, Damien Tudorhope, who resigned from his portfolio after it was revealed that he owned some shares in Transurban, which is a massive toll road operator, which has profited hugely from the government, particularly from this term, and in decisions that were made by Tudorhope and Cabinet when Tudorhope owned these shares. Now, it's neither here nor there whether or not he was biased. He probably wasn't. The issue is, though, that this is just, again, another example of just some of the details that tend to slip when you get into a fourth term of government. You've also had a string of ugly inquiries, more recently into property developer links with the Hillshire Council, which is an upper house inquiry, which has called in two of Perrottet's brothers for questioning. He describes it as a witch hunt. You've had his family members who have been unable to show up or been unable to be located. But again, the Libs are saying it's politically motivated. You've also had another upper house inquiry into John Barilaro's appointment to a trade position in the state. Again, these are just these sort of unedifying events that a government trying for a fifth term doesn't need holding over themselves at the moment, which is very interesting, which is why this polling is so interesting, which it shows that none of these are really dragging on Perrottet's personal brand, nor are they, which again is actually driving up the Liberal brand. Now listen to these figures. This is really fascinating. So Perrottet's increased his net favourability with New South Wales voters since October by about 12 points to plus 14, which is ahead of Minns, who's on 9. And he's also dragged the Liberal Party up. And the way we look at that is this concept of brand, which basically counts the primary voters who are likely to vote for the coalition, plus a group of voters who say that they could be persuaded to vote for the coalition. That Liberal Party brand's gone up 6 points. 7 points as well. And at the same time, we're seeing some other quite significant players in federal and state politics. I mean, Climate 200, for example, that dropped 8 points within the same period of time. Voters are more significantly more likely to say that they prefer Perrottet as Premier now in October. Again, 46% of New South Wales voters say that Perrottet is their preferred premier, whereas Minns on preferred premier is at 34%. But is it enough for another term? At the moment, no, it's not. So even on primary, even on a primary basis, so you've got Labor ahead, which is on 39%. You've got the Libs on 37%. Your Greens are holding about 10% of the vote. Independents are flat at 5%. Shooters are getting about 1%. You've actually seen a fall in popularity of minor parties down to about 8%, and that's down by 2%. But the interesting phenomenon, and we saw this at the 2022 federal election, we also saw this in the Victorian election, is we're seeing this larger group of undecided voters. So in October, that was about 12% of voters. Now it's about 15% of voters, which is about 700,000 people, and they are completely undecided, and they're actively considering the coalition and Labor. So it's really anyone's up for, it's either any of the parties up for the taking at the moment. One thing that most pollsters are convinced of at the moment is that we're likely on track for a minority government for either minority Labor or a minority coalition, which is why the crossbenchers are looking so important at the moment. In New South Wales, you guys are probably familiar, but we've got the Greens, which hold 3 votes. We've then got Alex Greenwich from Inner Sydney, Joe McGurr, who took Darryl Maguire's seat out in Wagga, Greg Piper up in Lake Macquarie, which is a notionally Labor-leaning area, as well as 3 former shooters who all left the Shooters Party at the end of last year, and they're all as independents now. You've got a block of 2, which is Roy Butler, who's up in the northwest of the state, Phil Donato, who's in orange, and then you've got Helen Dalton, who's down in Barwon, which is Murray, which is in the Riverina area. There's quite a split between these two former shooters of Butler and Donato and Dalton, and it's assumed that they will probably go differently in the event of they'll vote differently in the event of a crossbench. And then I'll just quickly end up on what's at stake and just the major policies that we're seeing from both sides. You've got cashless gaming, which is Perrottet's signature policy, which is proposing to turn every poker machine in the state cashless within the next 5 years. Labor's watered that down to a cashless gaming trial. You've got Labor, which is proposing to put $1 billion into a state energy security corporation to firm up pumped hydro and battery energy sources in the state. You've got a first home buyer choice from the coalition, which is giving first home buyers a choice between paying stamp duty or an annual property tax on properties up to $1.5 million. Labor is countered that by extending what we see at the moment, a Berejiklian plan, it's a stamp duty exemption up to homes of $800,000 with concessions up to $1 million. And there's an anti-privatisation agenda coming from Labor. The Libs have agreed to no more asset sell-offs. And then we've also got Minns, who's campaigning very hard on scrapping a public sector wage cap. He's saying that he's going to negotiate with the unions on wages. He says there's a brain drain and an exodus of public sector workers going to jurisdictions like Queensland, where cost of living is lower and they're also getting paid apparently marginally more in the public service. But there's no such plans to address that on the coalition side. So that's where we're at.
Interesting. Look, I think what you really highlighted there, Sam, is just how fragile this campaign is at the moment, that really the coalition is starting to find a bit of momentum, but Labor's still in a stronger position, but also the very broad variation in issues that voters are being asked to look at. There isn't, best people can tell, that one key issue that's really cutting through at the moment. That said, I am interested to hear from you all in what you think the key issue is heading into election day. And Amon, I might come to you first on this one.
Great. Thanks, Jack. Look, you know, there's definitely no shortage of issues, but I think the one thing that's that Labor's been pretty good at actually is sort of marking out the field. And I think they've used the issue of privatization really well, just in terms of a way to, as the vehicle, to encapsulate all their messaging around life is getting harder and harder. Yeah, it's brought together quite a few things. Cost of living, you know, the fact that things are getting harder for you and your family, it feeds into all of that. If the state is doing so well and people clearly are doing well off it, why aren't we getting the rewards? And that's a perennial theme often, particularly at state level. So I think for me, that's the one thing that's really cutting through. I mean, I'd love to hear what my fellow panelists think, but I still really haven't seen, you know, I think Chris Minns has done a better job of articulating a reason to vote for him. I'm yet to see the coalition articulate that reason. I mean, why would you vote for them again for another 4 years? I quite haven't grasped that. I think they've made a tactical error. I think they should have done a refresh straight off the back of Gladys Berejiklian going. The fact they haven't done that, it's almost as if they sort of waited a bit late for that. So, you know, I think that's another issue they've got to get their heads around. I mean, what is curious about that, and I think what Perrottet has done a good job of is just starting to get a bit of headway in terms of popularity. I think he's come from a long way behind there. Mm-hmm. The thing I would worry about, if I was, I always look at campaigns as the things I would worry about the most here. And it's interesting that the polling in the last few days, I think, really sort of sums up quite a few issues for the coalition. I mean, you look at the numbers, even today's Resolve polling. I mean, it's the coalition primary is now, 10 points lower than it was in 2019. That's a big, big drop. So you'd have to be concerned about that. Labor's actually up a point, right? Or they've gone up from, around 30, 33 or something. Apparently, according to Resolve, they're now on around 38. So the momentum is definitely going the other way. Andrew Clennell on Sky made a really great point yesterday. He did a very, very quick analysis and a comparison of numbers the Albanese Morrison result in New South Wales, basically. And he compared that to the where Minns and Perrottet are at the moment. And Minns is in a better position than Albo was, and Perrottet is in a worse position. So there you have it. So look, privatisation for me is the one that's really starting to resonate.
Interesting.
Yeah. Eamon, I'd love to ask you though, is are you getting any sort of feeling of flashback to 07? You know, if you think about Maurice Yemma going into that election, he had, you know, pedophile losing ministers left, right and centre, pedophiles, DV, drink diving, OB. There was this feeling of, you know, that they were in trouble. And yet, you know, they got over the line and Maurice held on. And I'm wondering if you can see any parallels to that, that's keeping you awake at night. I mean, obviously Chris Minns is better than Peter Dedham, and he turning up in his speedos, etc., wasn't great. But I think, you know, didn't Morrison have a really Yemma had, you know, a very similar situation as Perrottet has.
Yeah, look, yes and no. I think that's a good point, but I mean, I think you've just answered it, which is, you know, Minns is no Peter Debnam. I mean, Peter, you know, he was caught out perennially. Minns is someone who's, you know, he's really put his own mark on the leadership. Debnam coming to the leadership was off the back of a lot of coalition instability anyway and infighting. Minns has been able to get over that, I think, and he's really, you know, he's had a sweet run, particularly in the last 12 months. He's really put his own stamp on it. So I think he exudes just a level of comfort and a level of confidence without getting ahead of himself. And I think he handles himself really well. I look at the contrast in those performances. You know, I mean, not everyone watches the press conferences second by second the way people like us do, but over a period of time, it builds up a really, I think it leaves an impression. You look at Minns, who's always calm and he's measured and he speaks very, he just communicates with people, easy language, doesn't overpromise. Then I think you look at the Premier's press conferences and every day he's up, it's like he's fighting with somebody in the press gallery. And I know it's easy to get sucked into that. I've worked for leaders where that happens. But the result on camera at home is that he looks unhappy. He looks defensive. He looks rattled. And I think they need to get on top of that. So I think there's probably, I think there's less parallel. Having said that, Annie, everyone has problems. And I agree. I think the problems going into 2007 Morris,
I suppose the point is that, you know, you can have a lot of problems and still win, and that Labor's got a lot of work to do over the next, you know, 4 weeks to, you know, really get there would be, you know, my big observation. And also stating the obvious, you know, the, you know, one of the things that really helped the Federal Labor Party win at the federal election was the Teals taking away not just the taking away money and concentration of the party. I think the unsung hero, if the Libs are to get up at this point of time, is actually Matt Keane, who's done a fantastic job for the Libs with their climate policy. I'm saying a fantastic job for the Libs. I'm not saying, you know, a fantastic job, but he's done a very good in taking away the focus that the Teals took at a federal election. There's no Morrison. They've taken away climate change, and Keane had a women's budget as well. And so those key issues that distracted the Liberals, distracted the base, distracted money, distracted voter, took voters away, just aren't at play. And that makes it, you know, harder for Labor because they haven't got someone else taking away the Liberal seats and distractions. And I think that's something that is going to have very interesting consequences post this election if the Teals haven't made big inroads. And the other consideration there is the spending cap that is having a big impact on how this election is played out as well, which again, in the post-election analysis, will be really interesting.
Absolutely. And you're seeing that actually in terms of the environment as an issue. I know that probably one of the most interesting things we've seen over the past couple of months is that environment was ranked up about fifth or fourth in terms of importance or as an election issue for voters across the state. That has plummeted probably maybe to like the 11th most important issue. And it showed that by one reason or another, it might be Matt Keane, it might be something else, it might be cost of living, which means that voters have less bandwidth to think about the environment. But the environment has effectively been neutralised as an issue across the state ahead of this election. But, and there's a really big but, once you drill down into seats where there is a credible teal challenge, Pittwater, North Shore, for example, environment's still up in that top two or second or third most important issue. So it does show how febrile it is. It also shows that maybe some of these better heeled electorates are looking for a more aggressive approach on the environment than what Matt Keane has promised.
That's a very interesting point.
But as in the ability to grab a whole group behind, if you thought about he's systematically reduced that down as an issue. He also made sure that women, what wasn't an issue or weren't being ignored. And, that's a clever politics by him. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out. And a lot of people will be watching that. And the lessons learnt from that.
Yeah.
Jack, can I just pick up just answering the question, what is the most important issue in a slightly different way that goes a little bit to the campaign tactics that we're seeing, particularly perhaps from the Liberal side. If, as Sam sort of mentioned, it's cost of living and, Eamon sort of wrapped it all up as privatisation, which goes to tolls and everything else. But let's say it's cost of living. Bring into that housing, obviously the perennial issue in New South Wales, rental affordability crisis. These are big macro issues and they've sort of overtaken all the little issues in your electorate that you used to particularly worry about. You don't care about your clubhouse as much or your roundabout. You're worried about your family and your job and what's happening. And that sort of elevates it. The whole debate to a leadership level. You want to sort of look to your leaders and how are they going to help me through that, not how's my local member going to fix the roundabout. And that sort of plays into why we're seeing a little bit of this leadership, presidential kind of, issue. That's why, we're seeing a lot of Dominic Perrottet. It's why, the Liberal brand is very much tied to his performance. And I think picking up an earlier point, Dominic Perrottet has surprised a lot of people on the upside. They saw this conservative, deeply religious, six kids, now seven, sort of coming in. And, there was a lot of preconceived ideas about him. They found out that he's pragmatic, he's reasonably likable. He's not prepared to pick culture wars and, that perhaps they might have expected. He wants to govern from the centre. So I think that the Liberals are using that to sort of drag up their brand and improve their overall chances, across the electorate. So the other issue that, we're all Sydney-centric, and I know Sam was saying she's off on a regional tour in a minute.
Not all of us, Kai.
Not all of us, no, sorry, Annie. The other issue is this very significant and widening gap between services in the regions and services in the cities. And I think perhaps what we don't see as much in the media is in the regions, that is probably the number one issue. And it's tied up with cost of living, of course, and services and everything else. But education and hospitals, those things give, the opposition real things to campaign on and the independents in the region as well. So if I was going to sum up big issues, cost of living and gaps in services would be the two overriding issues.
Yeah. And speaking from someone who does live in a regional area, and it is unbelievable the gaps in services and just recently the Telegraph produced those education NAPLAN results and the difference between regional public schools and city-based public schools is just not only ridiculous but growing, and people are getting more and more concerned about that. If you look in Lismore, like the response in Lismore is not adequate, hasn't been good enough, but unfortunately for Labor, the vote in this, where I live in neck of the woods, often goes to the Greens. And I'm wondering whether this community, what you've seen in Western Sydney is, it used to be considered Labor heartland. It hasn't been Labor heartland. There's been seats changing in and out for quite some time now. Northern Rivers area, some of the big Green seats, they're voting heavier and heavier Green, and Greens cannot deliver in this point of time on services. And I'm wondering when, some sort of strategic voting might take place, like you saw for Liberal type teals to vote. But you're not seeing that at the moment, unless, of course, there's, minority Labor government, with the Greens, etc. But, you know, it is interesting in an area that is chronically underserviced in key things like disability, health, aged care, they're not swinging to a party that can deliver at this stage. And I think, they're swinging to the Greens. And I think that is, means more work needs to be done in the regions.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating. And we've covered off a lot there. We've kind of broken through on what the key issues are. And we've also spoken to the importance of leadership in this campaign in particular. I think one thing that a lot of us as communications professionals, and I know much of our audience today, working comms or corporate affairs, really like about election campaigns is we get to see the rubber hit the road when it comes to comms strategies. They contact reality and we see how they play out in real time, which is something that you don't really see on this scale very often. So I'm interested to hear from the panel, what sort of key communication strategies and tactics are you looking out for during the campaign? Or perhaps a surprise that you haven't seen so far. And Amon, we might start with you on that one.
Yeah, thanks, Jack. Look, so a couple of things from me. You know, I think this is going to come down to, well, one, there's no doubt about it. Let's not forget it's momentum in the early stages. That's making sure you got all the right announcements early on, but then quickly building that momentum. Because we all know that people engage at a far, far higher rate in the final 2 weeks. Mm. So I think, you know, I'm looking for both parties to be really just nailing their key themes, you know, that sort of second Sunday out, and then just running a very, very, very intensive, just electric by electric campaign, because they've both got things to prove, right? Both got things to prove, because they're both in the eyes of the electorate, relatively untested new leaders. So I think that's what I'm looking for. I think the other interesting thing I would just point out here is, for the first time in a long time, the Labour, they are not having to deal with the spectre of Eddie Obeid and some of those issues, those allegations. I mean, In fact, that's happened once where they had one of their own team or former member of their team in Tanya Mihailuk have a shot at them over Cal Aspel. But other than that, there's been really no sign of that. And then I think the contrast there with the coalition is you had a Premier who resigned because of the ICAC. But that report on what she's allegedly done is still not out. So the question is, well, why did she resign then? And so, you know, I think that for the first time in ages in New South Wales politics, the ICAC is not probably what it could be. But in terms of overall tactics and rolling out, you want them hitting all those key themes in the last 14 days for sure.
Yeah, Sam, have you seen any, you know, being on the trail, is there anything that's really stood out to you thus far, how they're communicating from the leaders?
I'm still yet to get to the bottom of this, but I know that Labor had a plan towards the end of last year that they were going to have the bulk of their platform out by the end of the year. That never happened. Also, I know very much within the gallery, Minns was in, had very good momentum towards the end of last year, and we had assumed that we could see Labor really capitalizing on that momentum within the first 6 weeks of the year. And actually, this progression into sort of third gear never really happened. And we're still trying to figure out whether or not, and it is looking like this at the moment, that from Labor, we're not going to see some big bombastic evolution of Chris Minns as the statesman-like leader. I think they're going to play Minns as a personality himself very, very safe. He's keeping on a tight leash. He's really not showing us that much of his personality. I know that personally, he's finding the discussion of religion throughout the campaign and being up against a premier who is very out and proud about their Catholicism. That is triggering a lot of questions of Minns. What are your religious beliefs? Where do you stand in terms of your Catholicism? How does that feed into your own policy formation? And I know that that's sort of one question that he hasn't been all that keen to answer, because I think potentially he's your average suburban dad, maybe, who's still trying to figure it out himself. Maybe that's a great political line that he's treading at the moment. But I think one thing that we won't see is we see Perrottet becoming more and more of this statesman-like character. I don't think we're going to see much more of an evolution of Minns beyond the stable administrative wing honed political leader that we're seeing him at the moment, and which I think is actually quite an interesting twist that we've seen in this campaign. I'm interested to know what you guys think. That's how it feels inside the bubble, at least.
Interestingly, I mean, I think we took a lot of lessons from the federal campaign, and one of them is perhaps the public wants a gentler form of politics. They're sick of the combativeness. You know, they want statesman-like leaders who can reach across the aisle. And I think, you know, sort of Perrottet's been playing to that to some extent. And you know, I think that will continue. And he's sort of contrasting himself, you know, with Minns, untried, untested. You know, my concern for Chris Minns is he can't play the Albo strategy because, A, he hasn't had the 3 decades in public life and the name recognition that, you know, Anthony Albanese's got, and B, he doesn't have Scott Morrison on the other side. You know, so that's concerned. What I will think you'll see in the communication, and this may not be from the Premier himself, but you will start to see a lot of questioning of, is Minns ready? Is Minns up to it? You know, and I think one of the things that probably doesn't help him at the moment is this superannuation debate and the idea that, you know, sort of the Labor government has basically misled the public and lied, and it is new taxes coming in, you know, and I think that might be exploited at a state level to say typical Labor. You know, they say one thing, they come in, they jack up your taxes. And you saw yesterday, I think, you know, that Perrottet was out with a read my lips, no new taxes. Just like he said, read my lips, no new privatisation. You know, these are the things that he wants to sort of rule a line under. And it's sort of setting it up a little bit to pressure the other side. How are you going to fund all these lovely promises?
Yeah, Clive, you know, I hear you say that and I think, oh, yeah, you know, danger, whatever. But, you know, I also feel like that is really old paradigm as well, that, and people are like, you know, I think Chris is, a very appealing. He's not trying to overreach. He's not trying to be, you know, this new, you know, big leader, alpha male. And I think that there's a lot of people who, you know, that he's appealing to. And if I was him and his team, I'd be really happy at this point of time to be where he is on the polling of preferred premier, because, you know, he's got a long way to come and he's doing extremely well to be at that point in time. But also because I do think that people, I really strongly believe this, that people are realising we've got a lot of big issues, whether it's climate, whether it's skills and education, whether it's the economy right now. And, you know, they're looking for people who will do the hard yards. And I think Jim Chalmers, talked about superannuation, will reap the benefits of taking hard decisions. Yes, the media are enjoying the role of it right now, but actually people know things have got to change and they know the economy's got to change. And I think that that parameter and our view of that and the right-left view of that is going to change over the next little while as well. That is not just a hope. I think that's why you saw people willing to vote Teals, et cetera. Mm-hmm. There is this dynamic shift in people's understanding of the significant problems and the significant bravery. And I think that Perrottet, for example, has been rewarded for fronting up about the Nazi costume, for, you know, saying, yes, there's problems with that, for, you know, people want that type of person. Now, we've had all the sort of showmen, we've had the, you know, we don't want a Trump, we don't want a Morrison, you know, we're looking for someone who can be smart and get on with the job. And I think that's the window for Chris Minns. And I do think you will see more of that come forward in the next couple of weeks as people start to really tune in.
Yeah, well, I think that's a really good point.
Yeah, I was just going to add to that. So Chris Minns did exactly that during COVID, when a lot of people thought he should have gone harder. And he deliberately said, no, bipartisan all the way, we'll support the government. Now, what was playing out electorally was the way there was geographical lockdowns. There was a lot of unhappy people, and that remains to be seen how much of that residual anger will carry over. I suspect a lot of it has since subsided, but there's no doubt about it. So there was a feeling that he should have maybe gone harder, and that and basically spoken out on behalf of a lot of people who were seen as coalition supporters, but who felt really hurt and really betrayed by some of those lockdowns in Western Sydney.
Yeah. That's an interesting point. I think we've talked a bit in that segment there about the impact of the Teals, female voters feeding into that, but also this distinction between Sydney and the regions, and particularly that service delivery piece. So how do we think the impact of perhaps a bigger crossbench at this state election, noting that so many of the teal seats were in Sydney, along with the fact that there's probably going to be a few regional independents, which will likely have quite different views to any teals in the Sydney city, in the Sydney city area. How do we think that's going to impact the results of this election and what comes next? And maybe we'll start with you, Clive, on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be obviously significant. I mean, most of the, Sam mentioned it at the start, most of the pollsters are saying you're looking at a minority government of one stripe or another. So clearly the crossbench becomes important. I think The Australian had a story this morning with McGurr, Greenwich, and one other independent whose name escapes me, sort of putting down their markers, you know, on what Piper, putting down their markers on, you know, what they'd be looking for from the government. It's about integrity, it's about environment, you know, for example. But there will, you know, there are some things that work against the Teals, obviously. There's things that work for them. There's a lot of retiring Liberals, you know, which make those seats more vulnerable than they should be. Optional preferential voting is obviously not a friend to independents. So it's unclear exactly how many you'll get, but you'll certainly have some of the shooters will get up. You'll certainly have those three that I mentioned almost certainly getting returned. So they may be the kingmakers at the end of the day. And the talk in that story this morning was about a 1991 Nick Greiner style pact, you know, sort of about, you know, this is what we demand to support your government. It's a big thing for independents to change governments, but they do sometimes. So, you know, and, you know, for example, Alex Greenwich, who you might assume might be more of a natural friend to Labor, but he's put a marker down, you know, cashless pokies is, you know, essential for him to support a government. So, you know, there are certain, you can't sort of predict exactly how that might turn out if it's a tight vote, but they'll look at the traditional things, the, you know, the popular vote, the 2PP vote, what a, you know, overall, you know, sort of who has the right to govern effectively.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
I think that that is, you know, I really, having disagreed before, I now really agree with that. But the other thing that I think is going to be really interesting, before the last federal election, we talked about the Teals and women and things like that. I think that the unknown here is particularly is young men and where they're going to, you know, men between 18, 35, they've had a very rough time of it. What a lot of pollsters tell me, and obviously 89 Degrees East does our own market research by Dr. Rebecca Huntley as well, and how hard it is to get young men to engage in polling and to, you know, to capture their opinions and things like that, particularly young men in regions and things like that. And I think that there is some very strong undercurrents that we're probably not aware of at the moment, and we don't even have a channel to understand where that group is at and whether they can pick up, you know, the Mark Latham's type people can pick them up, or whether some of the shooters and fishers or, you know, more Greens can pick them up. I think there's, you know, that is going to be extremely interesting to in the post analysis to see where that landed. And I think there are a lot of the undecided, it would be my guess, and from some information that I have as well.
Yeah, interesting. That's a very good point around what demographics are engaging. Look, before we move to audience questions in a couple of moments, I want to talk about that service delivery piece that we've come back to so much. It really is the bread and butter of state governments, be it health, a bit education, but we've also seen it in terms of building things. I mean, here in Sydney, anyone who lives in the city, I can speak to the fact that it's felt like a construction site for the better part of a decade now, with roads, metro, all these different things getting built. At the same time, so much of this is being funded by privatization. And yesterday, as mentioned, we saw Dominic Perrottet come out and say that's over now, and that these things are going to be funded by debt in the future. So I'm interested to hear, and I might come to yourself, Clive, first to start this one. How important is service delivery going to be during this campaign and in shaping the result, but also the distinction between what we've seen for those of us that live in Sydney versus, as you've mentioned, someone who might be living in Lismore or you know out in Dubbo or what have you, and the service delivery that they're getting?
Yeah, I mean, look, at a big picture level, infrastructure and service delivery should be a positive for the government. They certainly think it is. You know, sort of they're out there, you know, sort of talking about all the hospitals they've opened, the schools they've opened. You know, they're not shying away from the big infrastructure projects. They're obviously still pushing the metro, and you know, the other bit of WestConnex is now open. So hopefully some of the building sites start to subside. So it should be, you know, a positive for them. Obviously, we touched on it before, the regions are very different and there's still a genuine feeling that they're missing out. So, you know, that is clearly something for the opposition to exploit. But we're not, in terms of service delivery, there are pinch points. There's emergency department waiting times. There's nurses pay, teachers pay, school overcrowding. But there's things that, you know, so the opposition can certainly exploit. But we're not facing perhaps what we had back in, I think, the 2011 election, which was basically won or lost on hospitals and health delivery and day in, day out, people dying, waiting for care and a real campaign. In fact, we saw it a little bit in the South Australian election with the ambulance ramping down there. It was incredibly effective on service delivery. Doesn't feel like there's that momentum in this particular election around that. So I do think the government is not quite, I mean, it'll obviously be anxious about anything around that, but it's not one of the number one issues. Certainly it's bigger in the regions.
Yeah, fascinating. Sam, is there anything you've seen on the trail, and it is early days so far, in terms of service delivery and infrastructure that you think might cut through?
There's two things. I think Perrottet has a really big challenge trying to convince voters what's left in the infrastructure pipeline that they're going to get under a re-elected Perrottet government that they won't get under the Minns government. We're also at that point at the infrastructure building cycle that we're starting to see more of the data and more of the business cases behind sort of metro extensions and things like that, saying, like coming, like revealing some uncomfortable truths. Like you're paying, you know, $5 billion for 25 kilometers worth of rail, and the numbers actually just don't stack up, and these are turning into vanity projects. And I think that those business cases coming out of Infrastructure Australia, I think that they're going to start running up against what the government wants to do, and there's going to be a lot more scrutiny over whether or not they should be building. On the other hand, you have Labor, who has been able to ride off this infrastructure pipeline bedded in by the coalition. But they're really trying to build into their platform big promises for hospital upgrades. And I'm talking big money, like $700 million for a Rouse Hill hospital upgrade. There's another $400 million package for two hospitals out in Western Sydney as well. And these are the sorts of announcements that that tend to go under the radar because, I mean, as a journalist, how many words can you write about more hospital beds, that sort of thing, particularly, you know. So I think we're going to see more and more of a focus from service delivery from Labor, which I just think that the coalition is a bit flat-footed to respond to, mainly because, as Clive pointed out, service delivery, particularly in the cities, is okay. Yes, there's an argument for the country, but both parties will face that same challenge there.
Can I just jump in there? Like, so, you know, I totally get that. But, you know, I just think, wow, there's this massive opportunity. We've just gone through the biggest health crisis that most, you know, in our lifetime. People are so attuned to health, their own health. Where is the national prevention strategy, the state health prevention strategy? The best way to, like, stop spending money on these hospitals, you know, like the old cliche, the ambulance at the end of the cliff. But, you know, why aren't we getting, with all these big sporting events that are coming into New South Wales and to Australia, getting the community much more active and engaged and into their own health prevention? I mean, something like 60% of all health issues can be prevented. And I'm like, come on, Labor, come on, Liberals, show me your health prevention strategy, because that's what people, I think, will, at the age and stage that they are, you're going to get a really big bang for your buck. And it does, you know, Jack, we talked about like campaigning techniques and strategies and things like that. But I'm also for where's the modern idea? Where's the thing that says, you know, New South Wales, you're the engine of Australia's economy. You are the bright, young, shiny things. You're, you know, you can do all these tech things, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Like, come on, show us how we can absolutely transform our health system. You know, show us how we can use VR to change our education system. Like, what I'm hoping that, you know, in the last few weeks we start seeing some really smart ideas, because otherwise both and all the candidates are letting us down, because we actually need really smart ideas, and the technology is there to enable, again, whether it's preventative health or education, two massive drivers of community sentiment and also budget. And I don't think we're doing enough to articulate solutions that are, people do understand, they're there to be grabbed at. And I think the people who do that, the party or the individuals who can articulate that, will actually benefit a great deal. I think there's a huge appetite. You know, I think Australia's like the, wears the most smart watches in the world per capita. You know, I think, you know, we are the quickest adapters to technology. We buy the most, we upgrade our phones the most. So there's this, you know, understanding, engagement, and we can use, you know, I want to see those policies. And I'm a bit disappointed at this point, and I'm hoping that the last 4 weeks, you know, there's some bit more, you know, dynamic thinking that you think, yeah, I want to get on that. And, you know, that reminds me very much of the 07 election campaign for Kevin Rudd. It's the NBN, it was Kyoto, it was the apology. It was all this like fresh start feeling. And I feel like we could get a bit more excitement and a bit more interest, and I'm sure the journalists would love a bit more things to talk about than hospital beds.
Yeah,
I would love.
Where are you running, Annie? There's still a few pre-selections open.
that's a good point. Well, I think one last quick question. I'm just going to give this one to Amon, given I think he's got a bit of lived experience here, before we move on to a couple of audience questions. But it's looking perhaps more likely than not we're going to get a result in New South Wales that we'll see a change of government. And that would mean that for the first time in about 15 years, we're going to have wall-to-wall Labor governments on the mainland. Eamon, in your view, what should comms and corporate affairs and government relations professionals be doing to prepare for this possible outcome?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, right? Well, let me give you the quick internal view. When that happens and you have wall-to-wall governments of the same colour, you know, the staffing pool and people who are available, it starts to get hard, right? Because, you know, the competition for good staff, when you have a choice, you can work anywhere, basically. You know, so that actually starts to create challenges. But it means if you are someone who's looking to engage with the Labor government or Labor governments, now is the time. I mean, do not leave it too late. Get across what's actually happening, learn about the ins and outs and the dynamic of how this party works, and understand some of those relationships. One of the most fascinating transformations I've seen in terms of the political landscape and Labor and the unions is actually superannuation, because that turned everything around, and it's transformed a lot of unions from being seen as just people who make life difficult for corporate Australia. It's actually the people who united with corporate Australia and who are driving investment and profits. And that has changed a lot. Things are much more sophisticated. So anyone who's living in corporate world, if you don't understand the ins and outs of the Great Australian Labor Party, now is the time to work it out. You know, I would say that. But, you know, it also means that there is, you know, because of that competition for staff, there's people who may not necessarily have all the experience you might expect. So it's also a great opportunity to engage. And I find these days too, you know, it's not just red and blue, right? People do genuinely, if you're in government, you want to engage with everybody and you're wide open. So you'll find a lot of people who are much more receptive. And I can definitely say the number of people I would associate with the coalition turning up at Labor fundraisers these days, even despite the donation caps, is remarkable.
that's a short sign. Point. Look, I think let's move on to some audience questions here. We've got a few good ones through here, but I actually think we'll just go with one, given we're running a little short on time here. I think it's a good way actually to wrap the discussion up, because we can kind of show our hands a little bit, and it comes from Rory McDonald, and it's a question for all of us, and I'm going to say that we keep our answers here to the point, which is that on election night, what is the one thing we're each going to be watching closely? Sam, let's start with you, and then we'll work around from there.
It's not the sexiest seat. I'm going to say Riverston, which is in Sydney's sort of north western corridor. It's on a margin of 6%. Whoever claims Riverston is going to claim the election.
There you go. Clive, what's going to be the one thing that you're looking at?
Look, just for a personal interest, given there's so much bit noise around him, probably Stuart Eyre's seat out in Penrith. Hyper marginal. You know, he's got a big local presence. They put a lot of money into that seat. They would be very keen to hang on to that one. But, you know, it'll be quite a fight. It'd be interesting to see how all the jobs for the boys and the Barilaro inquiry sort of plays out on his personal brand.
Yeah, that's good. Annie, what about yourself?
I think that Jackie Scrubby will win in Pittwater, and that'll be the Teal win there. And I think that, and now I'm just going to go completely blank, but if that mayor in Western Sydney decides...
Frank Carbone.
Yeah.
Thank you. Sorry, Carbone. Mate, just completely... I think that is, he will win a seat there, and that makes it harder for Labor. And so I'll be waiting to see what he does there.
Amon, and the one thing you're looking for?
Mate, in the world where no one takes anything for granted anymore, particularly after 2019, I am looking at East Hills, the tiniest, tiniest of margins. If Labor does not win that seat and take it, and it is on 0.1% now, as we failed to do in the last three elections, there is no chance of a Chris Minns government. That has to fall early, has to be decisive. Great candidate. There are two pretty hardworking people out there, but I think Kylie Wilkinson is her second run at it, right? So she's got to, if it's now or never.
Interesting. And because Rory asked for my view, I'll say I'll be looking to see what happens with some of those Teal seats. If the Teals really start racking up strong first preference votes, I think the government is in real trouble. So look, it's been a really, really engaging discussion today. To those others who submitted questions, there are some good ones there. Unfortunately, we don't have time to get to all of them today. But look, I would like to thank our four panelists for joining us today. Clive, Amon, Annie, and Sam, their insights have been invaluable, and I'm sure we've all learned a thing or two from each of them. For those of you who aren't yet Stream customers, get in touch with us to learn what real-time media monitoring can do for your organisation. Over 600 of Australia's leading organisations, including the majority of federal government departments, many peak bodies, many state governments, choose Stream for their media monitoring leads. And you'll see in the email that you'll receive after this event today, a way to get in touch with our team to start exploring what Stream can do for you. Finally, I want to thank all of you who've joined us for making the time to tune into today's webinar. Your questions and your feedback have really added to today's event, and we look forward to seeing you for our next webinar. For now, have a great day and goodbye.
Thank you.